Feels like it's been a little while since we've been doing this study. I guess that's because I did several in a row, and then Tom did several in a row, and here we are. We're in the book of Esther. For those of you who are visiting with us, or for those of you who for whom it has been so long you've forgotten, we're in chapter 5 tonight, and for those who are visiting, tonight's going to really have more of a feel of a Bible class, perhaps a controlled Bible class, where I will dominate most of the discussion, and then we'll open it for some comments toward the end. And then we'll come back on Sunday morning and try to make some more practical applications out of this same text then. Esther chapter 5, as you remember, we are kind of at a dramatic moment in the story here. Mordecai has refused to bow to Haman, who took this slight, a touch personally, and decided that he was going to kill Mordecai. And not only Mordecai, he's going to kill the entire Jewish race. And he goes to the king with his plan, which is quite masterfully crafted as far as this sort of plan goes, at least so he thinks. It seems that way at the beginning. He gets his approval. The decree is signed and issued all over the world in every language imaginable. And that gets us then to chapter 4, which we talked about last time, where Mordecai learns of this and he goes and he appeals to Esther to basically change her perspective, to stop doing what he had said to do up to this point. You remember he has said to hide your identity, don't let anyone know that you are Jewish. And she has been extremely successful at this. She's been so successful that for the last 5 years, nobody knows that she's a Jew, so no one bothers to tell her that her entire race of people is about to be wiped out. She's been so successful that the king's right-hand man doesn't realize that the queen is one of these people that he hates so much, and he probably shouldn't try to issue this edict of extermination for the entire race, or extermination, as I almost said, which seems like a perfectly good word. But he does anyway. And so Mordecai goes and appeals to her and says, stop hiding your identity. Now is not the time to do that anymore. Go to the king. Beg the king for mercy that the edict will be changed. And Esther, for the first time in the story, has a little bit of a personality of her own. She has not up to this point. She's basically kind of been shuffled from point A to point B. She does whatever anyone tells her to do. She only seeks to win favor in people's eyes really by her passivity as far as it goes. Yet here we find her ordering her eunuch, which is not a big shock as far as a queenly behavior goes, but it's the first time she's done anything. We find her having some concern for herself. Her very, you know, instinct of self-preservation kicks in, and you don't hear anything about that in chapter 2, or her emotions about anything that's going on in chapter 2. She begins to argue with Mordecai, who she has always obeyed in every way up to this point. And here, what she says is, wait a second, you know, you're talking about all this death stuff, but if I go to the king, I'm going to die. This is the rule. Now, she does add the exception clause that if he holds out the scepter, that person will live. But there is but one law for this person. And that is the emphatic point, that whoever goes to the king is going to die. Now, there may be some exceptions in some cases, but that's not the standard procedure. If I go to the king, I am risking my life. Mordecai says, well, you're risking your life either way, because you're not going to escape the destruction that is going to come to your people. And at that convincing, she says, well, I will go. One way or the other, I will perish, but I will go. There is at least a chance that I will live if I go to the king. And she says, if I perish, I perish. She tells him to gather all the Jews, hold a fast on her behalf for 3 days and 3 nights. And Mordecai goes away obeying Esther. And there's a little bit of that role reversal that we talked about some last time as well. So that kind of gets our minds back into the story, a little bit more summary than I would typically do perhaps, but like I said, it's been a little while. So that brings us to chapter 5, and chapter 5 basically breaks down into three scenes. Two of them are kind of smashed together into a single scene. It is Esther before the king in his palace, and then Esther and Haman and the king at the first banquet. And then Haman and Mordecai, or his family as well. I guess you may say it's four scenes that are kind of smashed together into two, if you want to think about it that way. So we'll begin in this first scene. Verses 1 through 4. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne, inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached it and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request that shall be given to you, even to the half of my kingdom?" And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." And that's kind of where this first scene ends there, right in the middle of verse 5. A few things about this that are worth mentioning. First of all, we have a fair amount of solidarity going on here in a variety of different ways. Going back to the end of chapter 4, Esther has really shown no solidarity toward her people in any kind of way. She's been hiding her identity. The whole world doesn't know that she's a Jew. And what Mordecai calls on her to do is to have solidarity with her people, to join with her people and stand with her people and appeal for her people. And she says, "I will do this, but what I need is for you to gather the people to have solidarity with me." And that's what they're doing when they fast for 3 days and three nights. Just as she is going to join them, they are going to join her as well. And as they apparently continue to fast for a little while, 3 days and three nights, on the third day, as the fast apparently is still going on, she is going to take off the garb of mourning and sackcloth and put on her royal finery and then ultimately have a feast while they fast. And it is her feasting which shows her solidarity with the Jews, because she is going to appeal for them, and their fasting that is showing solidarity with her as they seek her best interest in this. Now, the fact that she is putting on her royal robes is in itself an interesting point to note. Quite literally, what it says is she put on her royalty, which I presume would include her royal robes and whatever crown she would have had. Anything that would be a symbol of her regality, of her position as queen, is probably what's going on here. Perhaps even the very attitude of being a queen, as opposed to the attitude of being a mourning person destined for destruction. But the idea, as much as anything, is that she is presenting herself in a certain light. She could go to the king in garb of mourning and sackcloth and hope that that would make a certain kind of impact on the king when the king saw her. "Oh, something terrible is going on with Esther. I need to find out what's going on." But instead what she does is she dresses herself as one with privileged status. She dresses herself as the counterpart of the king, the kind of person that should have the right to walk into the throne room without being asked. And so she aligns herself with him, really, as she aligns herself with them. And even so, her inner reality, her mourning and her desire to save her people, is certainly aligning more strongly with the rest of the Jews who are fasting than her outer reality. This royalty that she has put on aligns with Ahasuerus. And of course, putting on all of this queen's wear doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, the law is still the law. And if she shows up without being asked, the fundamental law is that she is going to die. And the only question is going to be whether the king happens on this rare occasion to show mercy on her. Dressing up like a queen to show up before a cranky king may be, probably not, but what it reminds me of is dressing up like a bear to walk into a cave. It doesn't guarantee anything. You're going into a dangerous situation, and who knows what is going to happen at the end. And of course, as we've talked about already, and this is probably something I should have mentioned as we were reviewing all of this, that all of this is going on at the same time as Passover, the Jewish feast of Passover. And we talked some previously about whether she perhaps should have celebrated the Passover and remembered God's great deliverance in moments like this, or whether this shows how important of an issue this is that they forego the Passover to fast on behalf of the people. Either way, it's striking because she is now identifying with the Jews and going to a court to deliver her people in the midst of the Passover. And that takes us again back to the story of Moses, as we've talked about before, that she is kind of following in that very footprint of what Moses did. But at the same time, you could point forward to her blazing a trail, so to speak, putting down a shadow of another great deliverer who will have a great deliverance on the third day, who is clothed in royalty and makes intercession before a great king. And so here there are echoes of Moses and foreshadowing of Christ as well, I believe. And of course, there's some irony built into this as well, because Vashti, back in chapter 1, risked her life when she broke a law. Well, she broke a command, you might say. The king said, "Come to my presence." And she risked her life by refusing to appear before him when she was summoned. And now Esther is going to risk her life by appearing before the same king when she is not summoned. And notice also here in verse 2 that she is referred to as Queen Esther. She's not been called Queen Esther a whole lot in the book. And this is something we noted back in chapter 1 as well with Vashti, where she was Queen Vashti, Queen Vashti, Queen Vashti, and then this edict that she will never come into the presence of the king again is written. And at that point, from that point forward, she's never called Queen Vashti again. It switches. And all of a sudden, she's just Vashti. And that's all she's called for the rest of the book. Here, it's the flip side of that, where she's just kind of been Esther all along. She won this contest, if you want to call it that. She's called Queen Esther once or twice, but for the most part, she's just Esther. And now she puts on her royalty to lead her people in a way to go stand before the king's presence, and she is now Queen Esther. And it will be the same Queen Esther that Ahasuerus saw back in chapter 2, the one that was appealing to him, the one that found favor in his sight. And that's going to be the same thing that we see. And that is his immediate reaction. He sees her and he shows favor to her. He knows that something significant must be going on. He knows the law. He knows the gravity of the situation. And only something really, really important would have caused her to appear before him in this kind of context, to come without being bidden. There's something that is obviously troubling her. And so what he says is, name your request. What is it that you want? I'll give you anything, even to the half of the kingdom. Now, this is probably best understood as typical royal exaggeration. A way of saying, whatever you want, I'll give it to you, without, you know, literally meaning, I'll give you half the kingdom. If she says, hey, that's a good idea, I want half the kingdom, probably that wouldn't have been what naturally followed as a result of this. It's royal exaggeration, not meant to be taken literally, to show that he's disposed to be generous to whatever her request may be. And so she says, here at this moment, where she has lived through the entrance, and the king has not only shown favor on her by keeping her alive, but he's shown favor on her by inviting her to name her request, whatever she wanted. You have one of the great anticlimactic moments of the Bible, where she says, let's have dinner. Okay, that's not quite what we're expecting. You know, she's won the king's favor. Why wait? Why not make the request now? And there's a variety of good reasons why she doesn't make the request now. But one thing that you probably have heard at some point is that she gets cold feet, or she's vacillating, or she's not quite sure what to do. She kind of chickens out at the last moment and just like, let's have dinner. And she just keeps putting it off because she's scared or something. That is, I would say, almost certainly not the case in terms of what's going on. And the reason why I would say that, first of all, is because it's obvious that this feast that she invites him to is part of the plan. We know that because she says the feast is prepared, and the king says, hurry, get Haman, let's go to this feast that is prepared. This is not something that, you know, she makes this request, and now what am I going to do? I better run through Publix real fast and get some chicken and take it back home so we'll have something to eat when the king gets there. No, this is a feast that is already prepared when she makes the request, which means her plan when she walks in the door is to invite him to the feast. So whatever she's doing, she's not just chickening out. I think is pretty clear here in this context. Which then makes you ask, why is she doing it? What's going on in her mind? And this is one of those spots, we've talked about this some with Mordecai already, that Mordecai is one of these kinds of mysterious figures that you don't know exactly what he's thinking all the time. In particular, where you most want to know what he's thinking is where you have the least insight into what he's thinking, as opposed to Haman, who's completely laid bare all the time, and you know his thoughts, you know his psyche, you know his ups and his downs and his mood swings and everything else, even as we'll see more this evening. You get a glimpse of that with Esther as well. You really want to know what's going on in her mind, and we don't have that. There are good things to think about, though, as far as this goes. There are significant challenges to this, and so there may be good reason to try to drag him along and butter him up a little bit more as much as she can. I mean, she's going to be asking for the reversal of an irreversible law that he ultimately is behind. And it'll be very hard for him to reverse it without losing face because it was authorized by his own signet that he had given to Haman. She is going to have to reveal her identity to the king, an identity that she's been hiding for the last 5 years. And who knows how he's going to react to that. I mean, it may be the kind of thing that he doesn't care one way or the other about. It may be the kind of thing that he's upset about. She probably doesn't know if he knows the race that's going to be... She probably presumes he does know the race that is going to be destroyed, even though Haman never bothers to mention it to him. And so how's he going to react to that? How's he going to react to finding out that she's been keeping this great secret from him all of this time? And so there are obstacles that just in themselves may make the plan of dragging things out a little bit better as far as winning his favor more and more and more along the lines. On top of that, there's just the element of drama that is involved, and I don't just mean that from the perspective of it makes it a better story, which it does do that. But more significantly than that, as she drags him along point by point, his interest is more and more piqued. He is more curious about what's going on, more favorable to give her what she wants as all of this tension builds. She has him on the edge of his seat, right where she wants him. Now, of course, that is a dangerous proposition as well, because piqued interest can turn into frustration in a hurry. You've probably seen one of those movies at some point in your life where there is, at the end, after the good guys have won, this one last obstacle that comes out of nowhere that they have to conquer, and they have to fight that last obstacle off, whether it's the bad guy coming back or whatever else the case may be. And then you've probably seen those other movies where they win and the obstacle keeps popping up like 7 or 8 times, and you're like, is this stupid movie ever going to end? Why do they keep doing this? I won't name names, but I remember in particular one movie that I just got incredibly frustrated with because it just kept going like that. And so she faces that danger as well. So there's in that kind of a two-edged sword as far as bringing him along slowly. But then there's some other practical stuff as well. You want Haman to be there. Haman needs to be there when Haman is accused, and Haman is not there in the court at that moment. You cannot have, if you're in Esther's shoes, a gap between the accusation that she makes and the resulting confrontation with Haman. One thing we know about this king is he basically listens to anything anybody ever says at any point. And so if she accuses Haman, the king is going to say, oh, Haman, he needs to die. And she goes on her way, having made her request and made her accusation. And then 30 minutes later, Haman comes in and says, hey, how's it going, king? Let's have a drink. And before you know it, they're sitting back on the couch laughing about how great things are. And either the king has forgotten or Haman has completely changed the situation into a different light where Esther is the bad person and not him. She needs Haman in the room when she makes the accusation before the king. And that's part of what she is setting up as well. She's got to guarantee his presence so she can press her advantage to leave no wiggle room for him out of it whatsoever when it's, you know, just the guys sitting around and hanging out. And she is enacting a plan is what she is doing. We've not been told what her plan was to this point, but she is enacting this plan. The dinner is made, and we'll see even more as we continue on. And so then, beginning in the middle of verse 5, the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared, and as they were drinking wine after the feast, The king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And so another moment of anticlimax here. The story skips entirely the feast itself. We have no idea how big of a feast it was, how many servants there were, how fabulous the hall was, what food they ate. It just gets right to the point where the feast is over and they're drinking, and you come back to the king's question. But notice again, it's while they're drinking. The narrator seems to enjoy pointing out the fact that the king and the Persian royals are constantly drinking as they make their decisions. And we've talked about this already, that this is a bit satirical, I think. It's a way of poking fun at these Persian leaders. But it's also historical that the Persians did do a lot of drinking even as they made decisions, if you go back and read records about the Persian people. And again, Ahasuerus asks what she wants. He knows that this dinner that they're having is not what she really wanted, you know. She shows up unbidden. Something must be wrong. "What do you want, Queen Esther? Even to the half of my kingdom, I'll give it to you. We'll come to a feast." Okay. All right, well, that was her request. I came to the feast. See you later, Esther. No, he knows it was something more significant than that. And so he poses the question again. What is it that you want? It's not just a dinner date. What are you really seeking here? And again, it seems like a perfect chance. He's disposed to answer her. He is, again, offering up to half the kingdom. She is there. He is there. Haman is there. They're all drinking, and yet she puts it off again. And this is probably where it would most look like she gets cold feet and puts things off even further. But I would point out to you the wording, the very careful wording in verse 8 when she does answer this. She says, "If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request." Notice that first of all. What she says is, if you really are looking on me with favor, and if you really are going to do what I'm going to ask, then you can show that to me. If I have found favor in your sight, if it pleases the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the feast that I'll prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. There are two just absolutely brilliant things that she is doing here. First of all, she is flipping things so that instead of the king doing what she wants, she is doing what the king wants. Now, she is still going to make her request, but notice as it all wraps up, "I will do as the king has said. I will do what you have ordered if you come to this feast tomorrow," which itself is a pretty clever thing for her to do before the king. But then the second thing that she does, and the more important thing, and the thing that shows that this is part of a plan, not ad hoc chickening out and making things up as she goes, is she says, "If you're going to really grant my request, then come to this feast tomorrow. And that will show me, before I even ask it, that you're really going to do this." So the moment he walks in the door, he has signaled to her that, "Yes, I am really going to do what you ask." It is more than just, "I found favor in your sight." It's more than just this kind of grand promise up to half the kingdom. He is showing her in a very definite way by his presence at the feast the next day that he is really going to do what she asks when she asks it. And it's a remarkable strategy. It's a remarkable thing that she has done. He has basically promised before he has heard what the request is that he is going to fulfill the request. The other thing that she's doing, probably here as well, is by having the extra banquet, she's giving the king an opportunity to think, why does she keep wanting Haman around? I mean, if you have a beautiful queen, and you haven't spent time with her in quite a while, as it seems to be the case here, when she starts showing up and wanting to spend time with you, it's probably not the greatest thing to always have this third wheel hanging on the side. Why does she keep asking for Haman? And, you know, we don't know exactly what she's doing, but you could even almost hear her making the request or making eyes at Haman in such a way that is going to provoke the king's anger even further as far as it goes. And whether or not she's doing all of that, of course, we can't know, but it at least has the potential of sowing seeds of resentment in the king's mind toward Haman. We'll see in the next chapter that he is staking far too big of a claim in the kingdom itself. This may suggests that he is staking too big a claim in his wife's esteem. And we'll see that's really not beyond his thinking as the story continues when we get to chapter 6 into chapter 7 as well. And again, this sets up a nice contrast with what she does and what Vashti had done back in chapter 1 as well. Here she is very obsequious in terms of how she is approaching the king, where Vashti was just obstinate. She is deferential where Vashti had just been defiant. And as this scene ends, she has invited the king to her banquet where he will do what she wants him to do. And he has already said as much. Well, we'll have to get to that banquet on another day. But the story continues with Haman leaving in verse 9. Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, and all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast that she prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. Well, Haman departs from the palace that day, and he is having the best day of his life. This is the greatest moment since the promotion to this position. He is joyful and glad of heart. The queen keeps inviting him to all of these banquets, and no one else. He has aspirations of royalty. He does. We'll see this in chapter 6, where he thinks when he's going to have this great parade for himself, what he wants to do is ride on the king's horse and wear the king's clothes. He wants to be a little king is what he wants to be. And being invited to these private meals with no one but the king and the queen raises him up on this level of royalty, at least it does in his mind. This is the greatest day that he has ever experienced for about 5 seconds, and then Mordecai is not terrified of him, and suddenly it's the worst day of his life. And that in itself tells you about all you need to know about Haman, and about all you need to know about ego, and we'll probably come back and talk about that some more on Sunday morning. But here Mordecai doesn't show respect for him by rising before him. It's kind of ironic because last time he got mad, he wasn't bowing before him. Now he's not rising before him, and he's not showing fear by trembling before him. You would think that after this edict has been signed and sent all over out, that Mordecai would be afraid of Haman. Yet he's not. He doesn't tremble before him. And Haman is livid, yet he restrains himself. He runs back home to his wife and his friends here, and they advise him as he throws himself, you know, the greatest pity party of the entire Bible, perhaps. And this itself is just an absurd scene when you stop and you think about it. I mean, if you're going to go through all of the great things about how wonderful a person you are, and, you know, there may be some legitimate occasion for that on some reason for some way, but the people that don't need to hear about it are the people that know you best. Let me call my wife, and I'll tell my wife about how many kids I have and how much money I have and my position with my employer. And my best friends, I'll tell them all this too. I mean, they might not know the money part, but they'll know the rest of it very well, right? This is just an absurd scene to begin with. He's trying to build his own ego back up. His ego has been destroyed by what happened with Mordecai. And so he's trying to build it back up with these people that would be there to bolster him in some kind of way. And so his wife, you know, you can almost imagine her, you know, laying him on her lap and stroking his hair and trying to calm his poor little soul down. But what she says is, this is what we'll do. We'll build these gallows 50 cubits high. I don't know if your translation has a footnote here. Translation I'm reading from says stake as an alternate translation to gallows there. The reason why stake would come up as an alternate translation is that the word here is just the word for wood or tree. And that in itself could be interpreted in a variety of different ways. When you think of hanging, when we think of hanging, at least from our cultural context, we typically think of things like gallows, where someone would be hanged on these gallows. And that's a legitimate translation of this. I mean, you've seen people hanged from trees, at least in movies and such you have. But what we know from Herodotus, who reported on Persian history, and what we know from excavated stone reliefs of Persian palaces and such, is that the Persians impaled the executed criminals. And so probably the gallows here, the tree, is not a tree that they would be hung on with a noose, or gallows that they would be hung on with a noose, but a stake that was erected for him to be impaled upon, which helps explain how they could build something so big overnight. You just have to find a really long stake. It's all you need to find, and it's pretty quick to build it. You just got to find a long one. And also, it's worth noting that the 50 cubits gallows may not be intended to be read as a literal height of the actual stake that they use. It shows up a couple of times. It shows up here in the words of his wife. It will show up again in the words of the eunuch who refers back to it as well. You know, if I said, or if, maybe I'm not going to say that, if somebody in our cultural context said, let's build a 100-foot stake to impale somebody on, would you think it's actually necessarily definitely going to be 100 feet tall? Or is that just kind of a figurative way of saying really, really tall? And we understand how that works. And 50 cubits would work in a similar kind of way. It may actually have been 50 cubits. I'm not going to tell you that it wasn't. But the narrator never comes along and confirms the actual height of what his wife says, let's build. And the eunuch refers to in passing that there is this giant thing in Haman's backyard that he was going to kill Mordecai on. And so it may or may not have been that exact height. What's more significant as far as imagining the scene is that it probably is more this idea of a stake for impaling than gallows for a noose sort of hanging. Now, of course, what all is forgotten in all of this is that Mordecai is already a condemned man. And this is the problem with Haman's ego as well. He does not have the patience to let his own plan that he has so carefully crafted play itself out. If his ego would have allowed him to just sit back and wait a few more months, Mordecai would be dead with the rest of the Jews. At least he would have a good reason to think that that would be the case. But no, he's not patient enough for that, and now he has concocted two different plans to kill Mordecai. For what it's worth, both of them are going to backfire. Which again shows the finer working of what God is up to in the story of Esther. The date that is set for the widespread destruction of the Jews is going to be the widespread destruction of those who hate the Jews and oppose the Jews. This stake that is intended to single out Mordecai as first among those who were executed is going to make Haman the first of those who was executed for being opposed to the Jews. And of course, you have to think in terms of Haman's ego that if he actually succeeded in this, he wouldn't have been happy. Because as Mordecai is lifted up there high above the city on this stake, every eye would be on Mordecai, and nobody would be looking at Haman. And that in itself would have been a bitter pill for him to swallow, is still nobody is paying any attention to him whatsoever. And of course, on top of all of that, there is the fact that Haman runs home to ask for advice from his wife, which is in direct opposition to the stupid law that is passed back in chapter 1 about every man ruling in his own house. Not that husband's authority is a stupid law. You know what I mean. That's not going to be on the recording, is it, Jonathan? We can take that off. So that's kind of a glimpse at this story. Like I said, we'll come back some more on Sunday and talk at least about Haman's ego. We'll draw some other ideas out of this chapter as well. But that, I think, is a fair quick run-through of this chapter and some of the significant points, at least some of the points that I see as significant here in this chapter. But as we do, we'll open this up for some discussion for the next few minutes. Any thoughts or questions or comments, accusations? Yeah, Jonathan.
The king has tended to appear very bright up to this point in the story. So the fact that he sees when Esther comes to him that this is more than just a dinner invitation. There's something, there's got to be more behind this. Seems like that would be a testament to just how dangerous it was to go see him like this. That even he realizes no one would be stupid enough to do this without an important reason.
Yeah, for
he recognizes this is unusual or significant. To me, it seems like an indication of just how truly dangerous it was.
Yeah, and like you say, especially in the context of this king seeming to be something of a buffoon, for him to realize how dangerous this is does speak to how dangerous of a moment this is for Esther. And we tend to get fixated on the accept to whoever the king holds out the scepter, and I think it's in part because we know that he is going to do that and spare Esther's life, and we can read right over this without picking up the significance of just how dangerous this is. I mean, when she says, "If I perish, I perish," I mean, she is, I think, expecting to die. I think that is her basic expectation. I'm definitely going to die if I don't go do this. I'm probably going to die if I do, but this is what I have to do, and if I die, I die. I think is probably a way of seeing that, or showing that is kind of what she expects to happen here at the end of this chapter. Charlie? Yeah, well, some of it may just have to do with how the court was situated and those kinds of things that we can't know. I mean, I imagine that we're not talking about a tiny little room where the king's court was, where, you know, he's sitting here and the door's 15 feet away, and as soon as it opens, he definitely is going to see it. It may be something as simple as it's a gigantic hall, and he's on one end of it doing some kind of work and doesn't hear the door open, and she begins to approach, and when he looks up and sees her there. It may just kind of be the natural way that it worked. I don't know. Beyond that sort of thing, I don't know why it would be written as when he saw her standing there as opposed to when she entered. I think the idea is ultimately the same either way. She's entered and he sees her. The details of how that all works out, I don't know, is as significant.
I didn't know if that was another sly anymore.
Yeah.
He chose to use words when he saw her versus what she wanted.
Yeah, I don't know. Greg?
She's strictly being pragmatic. Okay, I do this, and bunches of people are going to die. I can do this, and I die, and everybody else dies, but maybe all these other people get saved. Or was she trusting in God? Or because it really, she does at least recognize she's Jewish, but. But either way, she does show character and sacrifice and willingness and courage.
Yeah.
I'm sure
well, I mean, there certainly is. I mean, there's some degree of pragmatism to it because, I mean, that's what Mordecai's argument is based on. You're going to die anyway, and so you might as well go and try to save our people. And we talked about that statement as well. Relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place, or as it could be punctuated, it won't rise from another place. And you're the only hope, and we'll leave that discussion behind as well. But there is some level of pragmatism to it. But as it moves on to this, hold this fast on my behalf, and as we talked about when we talked about chapter 4, fasting is almost always accompanied with prayer, or as part of some religious fast, or a religious ritual of some kind. And just the common sense of it, that having a, you know, having a citywide fast on her behalf doesn't make sense without it being some sort of appeal to a higher power. I mean, it's going to be really helpful for me if all of you are very hungry when I go risk my life. Doesn't make sense. What makes sense is if you fast and pray. And so I think there is, on the one level, some pragmatism to it. But when she says, fast for me and I will do this, and if I perish, I perish, there is still that, I think there is some confidence in God, this appeal to God, appeal to a higher power to help her out, to protect her, but also not knowing exactly what's going to happen. Kind of like, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Our God can do this, our God will do this, but if he doesn't, well, this is what we're going to do anyway. And so there may be some of that in what she's saying. Yeah, Brian? yeah, I mean, it may be, I think it's basically he's not striking out against Mordecai in some way right now, and not even physically striking out against him, which probably what he wants to do is just kill him on the spot, and he doesn't do that. But also probably no overt external show of emotion, because if it was obvious that Mordecai was getting to him, then that would show Mordecai as the one with some power in this scenario, especially if Haman can't do anything about it right now in the open. And so it's a way of not publicly showing his personal animosity toward him, although I have a hard time knowing everyone doesn't know about it anyway. I mean, there's already been this discussion out in the open of whether Mordecai has the right to do this. And then suddenly, after he doesn't, this edict pops up about Mordecai and all his people dying. I think everyone's pretty well aware of it. But still, it's a way of not showing that Mordecai has some power, has some control of the situation. It's a way of Haman protecting his ego in the public eye, at least, even though he's not doing a good job of protecting it in actuality. So that would be what I would say, at least off the top of my head, about those kinds of things. Yeah, Jonathan?
Do you know anything specific about the significance of Esther touching the top of the scepter when she comes in?
No. Not that I'm aware of. As far as I know, there's not a whole lot of record of this kind of thing outside the Bible either. I mean, there is record of how dangerous it was to appear before the king, but the holding out of the scepter, the touching of the top of the scepter, I've not found anything about the significance of it. It may be just simply a way of receiving the divine favor, or the kingly favor. I mean, he may think of himself as divine, that he is, you know, he's showing his favor, not killing her. She touches it to symbolically receive that. It's a good question, though. Yeah, very formal kind of thing.
You know, this strikes me as this kind of Eastern negotiating tactics, you know, back and forth. Mm-hmm. You know, her putting off the actual request. It just seemed to me that's how things were done. It's not, like you said, getting cold feet. Or,
yeah.
You know, it's all been planned from the beginning. This is the way to do it. And it builds up, again, the suspense and expectation of what important.
And Haman just keeps thinking, look how important I am. You know, you've got this Mordecai and how awful he is to me, but look how important I am. Because Esther keeps inviting me to all these banquets. And he thinks if I can just get rid of Mordecai, then everything will be great. And it'll be me and the king and the queen and how wonderful things are as I keep getting invited to these banquets. Yet, the real danger that is facing him has nothing to do with Mordecai and everything to do with Esther. And whether or not his edict will stand is a separate thing, as we'll see, but the personal danger that is going to face him, has nothing to do with whether Mordecai bows or rises or trembles or anything else. It's the fact that the queen is out for his head and he has no idea. He thinks this is the greatest thing ever. Yet in reality, she is just, you know, weaving the web tighter and tighter, and he is going to be struck very quickly when that moment comes. Yeah, Brian?
It really shows how backward his thinking is, that the thing he should be worried about, he has no idea about. The thing he really shouldn't care about, like, completely controls his thought process.
And there's probably a good lesson in there about not getting obsessed with stuff. You know, letting some individual personal slight become the greatest driving thought. That's when you start missing other things and wind up, you know, caught in someone else's web, so to speak. Yeah, Charlie?
Yeah, it's interesting that his resolution is a 75-foot gallows, whether the tower of it's 75 feet or if it's like build a platform with the stake, you know, whatever it was that, you know, work out around that. They're like, hey, there's this huge thing in the back of the backyard. It's very interesting how ridiculous it is. Like, it's not, hey, you know, let me just, you know, chop his head off, or hey, let me, draw him a quarter head. No, let me build this huge, old power statue size thing to put him up on. And almost goes back to the thing of, you know, he wouldn't be satisfied because everybody would be, like, completely staring up, you know.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's equivalent to a 6 or 7 foot story building.
Yeah, it's giant size vengeance for giant size ego, and he's not going to be happy until he does overkill on this the way he does overkill on everything else. And he thinks that once this is done, I mean, what his wife says is, after this, then you can go joyfully with the king to the feast. And of course, that's going to backfire because he's going to try to go get this permission, and that's going to explode in his face. And he's going to go to the second feast, and he's not going to be joyful as he goes, and he's going to be less joyful when he leaves. So what he thinks is going to solve this problem really becomes the moment of everything really beginning to blow up for him. Brian?
I wonder how many times stuff like this has happened where Haman kind of gathers his friends together and kind of has a little pity party, like you said, where they just offer him some advice on what he should do. I wonder how many, part of me wonders whether the wife and friends are just kind of exaggerating, trying to make light of the situation. It's like,
yeah, and that's one of those things too that she's gonna have a whole lot of wisdom later on in the next chapter. We'll come to this later. I presume you're familiar with this already, so I'm not giving anything away. After all of this explodes in his face, what she says is, "Oh, Mordecai, he's a Jew. Well, you can't beat him. you're gonna fall before him if he's Jewish." You're like, wait a second. Everyone, the entire book has called him Mordecai the Jew. How did you not know this up to this point? And where was this wisdom when you were telling your husband to kill this guy? And it really does, you know, it almost sounds like, or seems like, yeah, she may know all of this all along, but it's just kind of pat Haman on the head and you know, push him on, give him the advice that he thinks he wants. And then, you know, once it all does come crashing down, yeah, you should have seen that coming, Haman. The rest of us were pretty aware that this is what was going to go on. But it does raise the question then, you know, where was all this wisdom back in chapter 5 when you were advising him the first time?
Just his pride, how fragile it was.
Yeah.
How hard he felt. You know, one guy all of a sudden going back home.
Yeah.
You know, crying to his friend saying, you know, what am I going to do with this guy? And you think he was that big of a leader, he was out on his own.
Ego is a funny thing, and then we'll end on this point today. I think it seems like a good spot to end. We talked back in chapter 1 about the fragility of power, and the king thought he had all this power, and then when the queen said no, the whole world comes crashing down around him, and it seems like this really big thing, but it's really just as fragile as can be. And ego is the same way. And like I said, we'll talk more about this on Sunday. But I'll leave you with this image of it that I picked up somewhere along the way, and I think it's a helpful way of thinking about ego. It's a lot like a balloon. The more air that goes into it, the smaller of a pinprick you need to pop it. And the bigger your ego is, the smaller the slight is that is needed to offend you and upset you and set you down on a path of vengeance. And one of the things that we have to keep in mind as we think about our egos and we think about offenses that are done to us are the offenses that we've done to other people and the offenses that we've done to God. And the reality is that the more we are offended by other people, the more easily we are offended by other people, the more traumatically we are offended by other people, the less we realize how bad the things we are, that we have done, really are. If we had a truer sense of our own sins, if we had a truer sense of our own offenses against other people and how we've harmed other people, then what other people do to us wouldn't make nearly as much of a difference. It's when our ego swells to the point that the smallest pinprick can pop it. The only way we get to that point is if we have minimized view of our own failings. And so it's a helpful thing not to wallow in our sin, not to wallow in our guilt, not to wallow in the mistakes we've made, but to keep in mind the fact that those are a very real part of our lives, that we have sinned against other people, that we have done bad things to other people, that we have harmed other people, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, but we have slighted and offended people. And the more aware we are of that, the less offended we're going to be when other people do things to us. And even far more significant than that is the reality of what we have done against our very Creator and the sins that we have committed against Him. And how could we possibly be so easily offended at what people do to us as if we're somebody so great when we realize what we have done to God? And that, I think, should be a humbling kind of thought that helps shape the way that we interact with other people, especially when they sin against us in some way. Well, if you take your supplemental songbook and turn to number 8, we will sing this as a song of encouragement and exhortation, as we typically do, because we like to take an opportunity to let people know that if there's something that we can do for you, we can do that. And so as we sing this song, if there is any way that we can help you, just let it be known as we stand and sing together.